John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
Welcome to a legal conversation hour. Today I have succumbed after many, many years of saying no, 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 no. I've said yes, okay, let's have a legal theme to the conversation hour today. I tend to self-censor on some of these issues, but we have wonderful guests joining us, including my co-host I'll introduce in just a moment. Lots of yarns, some of them, I don't know where they're going to go, these boys. Alan Goldberg is a retired federal court judge. Howard Nathan is a retired Supreme Court judge. They are, between the two of them, regarded as two of the more, witty, occasionally irreverent members of the legal community in Melbourne. They both have a long history of being great storytellers. There's been a scholarship named in honour of Alan Goldberg. Interestingly, it's not, in the usual style of philanthropists, it's not unusual for people to give a great chunk of money to an educational facility and say, here, name something after me. But this is the other way around. This has been named after Alan, but the money's been provided by people who he used to act for when he was a lawyer. In gratitude, Alan Goldberg, QC, and Howard Nathan, QC, both retired judges, joining us shortly. So, when I got a press release across the desk saying that the former Commonwealth Attorney General, Nicola Roxon, who's now at Victoria University, amongst other things, was tomorrow participating in the opening of a new Courts and Tribunals Academy, a kind of school for judges, well, I thought all that fits in very well. Let's throw them all in together and see what happens. Nicola Roxon is the adjunct professor now and chair of the Sir Zelman Cowan Centre at the Victoria University here in Melbourne. Nicola Roxon, welcome back to the conversation now.
Thank you for having me.
Just goes to show there is life after politics.
Oh, there sure is. There sure is. Now, I need to tell you and your audience very quickly, though, that this Courts and Tribunals Academy is, in fact, not for judges. It is for all those other people that work in courts and tribunals who support the judges, because there has been a big focus on the judges, not surprisingly. They're the decision makers, and our two guests have got an amazing, colourful history in our courts. But it's actually all the people that run the courts and are often the ones that interact with the community who haven't had much attention to their professional development. And this program is really centred around that and how we make sure courts can deliver more with what is always going to be a fixed budget from governments and difficult to grow.
Have you just lifted the lid on a massive scandal? Do you mean judges don't run the court? Next you're going to tell us that surgeons don't run hospitals.
Oh,
you used
my
to be
goodness.
The health minister.
I
too.
Know. Look, this is controversial. This, you think this could be the triumph of the nurses and the CEOs of courts. Really, judges are, of course, the heads of jurisdictions. And they
just ask them, they'll tell you.
And they are the crucial people. They make the decisions who goes to jail, who doesn't, who pays millions of dollars of compensation. But in order to do that job, particularly in the modern world, they do actually need to have very efficient and proficient staff. Luckily, lots of our courts have that, but there hasn't been much focus on how to take it to the next level when our other public sector organisations and actually private ones really are looking at how they use technology and how they use different types of systems.
Technology? Have they got electric lights yet?
There is that famous saying, and I particularly always said this having moved from health minister to the attorney in my political life, that famous joke that if you went back to the time of Dickens and were in a hospital, and you went to a hospital today, you'd see the massive advances in technology and human endeavour. If you went to a court in that time and today, you might not notice as much difference as you'd expect. Now, I think that's a bit unfair. I think our courts have done a huge amount to modernise, but
in fact, they now have lots of them computers. They're not all like the Royal Commissioner at the Trade Union Royal Commission, Dyson Heydon, who famously explained that he didn't know about the invitation to a Liberal Party fundraiser because he doesn't know how to use emails.
Well, I think you're finding actually the new generation of judges are and their staff are, of course, using technology in different ways, but like everyone. I mean, I'm 48 and I find some of the new technology a challenge, and you've got to make yourself use it and you've got to look at what systems can actually work and which ones are just fads.
You use Periscope yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. What's
so
that?
You could probably go through a whole you could go through a whole list of them. In fact, the first time I tried to use WhatsApp, it turned out it was actually somebody bug, and it meant that every single person in my address book got sent a diet program. So all the mothers at school said to me, "So what are you trying to say, Nicola, sending us this program that we need to lose weight?" It was terribly embarrassing. So
yeah, you can
have problems as
you
well.
You can easily make mistakes and things that you then forever regret. There's no doubt about that, and that's part of why some people just stay away from it entirely. So what's the Courts and Tribunals Academy, to cut to the chase, what is it actually going to do?
So it's actually the first in Australia that is going to be dedicated to looking at the specialisation that courts and tribunals have, supporting the sort of work that they need to do, but not being afraid to draw from other program. So you'll have the graduate diploma in court and tribunal management actually will look at everything from IT through to executive management through to current issues in the law, handling difficult consumers. Now, we know there's lessons.
Self-represented litigants, yeah, which is exploding because of the absence of legal aid.
Yeah, you know, the reach for justice now into communities that find it hard to access the justice system, particular issues in dealing with children and those who are in distress. We know that Centrelink, for example, or just picking that as an example, has massive expertise. Why do we think that you can't use some of that expertise and knowledge in the courts? So the courts are special and unusual, but there are some things that are similar where we can share more information. And around the world, these sorts of academies exist to help ensure that courts can run to their best capacity. So we've got some partnerships internationally already established, which means we'll look at metrics and all sorts of things that really haven't been used in our courts, with a research base and a training base for students who probably most likely will be those already working in the courts and tribunals.
Now, it's long been a mantra, who judges the judges, and this may be a recurring theme with our next two guests as well, but it's very difficult when you have absolutely entrenched, locked into the very core of our legal system, that judges must be scrupulously independent. No one can tell them what to do. So if anyone tries to tell them you have to hear a case within this time or according to these guidelines, they say, hang on, you can't interfere with my independence.
Well, I think particularly with my background as the attorney, the protection of independence for decision-making is crucial, whether it's protection from governments interfering or others. But I actually don't think that this in any way tramples on that important principle, because this is about having effective organisational structures, having really top-class people, well-trained, that are helping the court run smoothly. It will make the life of judges easier, but probably more importantly, it will make the life of those people who come before the courts easier. And ultimately, that's the community impact that it's so important for us to be able to focus on.
I saw an article in the paper earlier this week, Nicola Roxon, that said that only 8% of graduates with teaching qualifications in New South Wales are going to get jobs as teachers next year. 8% only will get jobs as teachers. That's astonishing. It was only one state, one profession, but the same is happening. We've got an oversupply now, don't we, of people being churned out by all the law schools. There's just not enough jobs for them.
There's certainly a lot in the media, and there do seem to be, anecdotally, and I don't have access to anything other than the anecdotal information, there are bright young students who are finding it much more difficult to get jobs. Mm. This is not adding to that. Victoria University already has a law school that has a particular niche, often not just for school leavers, but for people who have another degree and want to add law at a later time in their career. So very interesting social workers and police prosecutors and others.
And people doing it part-time?
Yeah. And this is actually much more likely to be for people that are in the courts and tribunal system who want to get this graduate diploma to specialise in what they're doing.
Or to get a promotion.
Yeah,
to.
Or it may be from people who are otherwise involved in the system in some way and would like to step their career into the courts. And the more we see that sort of movement between the courts and other parts of the legal system, between the public sector and other parts, I actually think that is a healthy exchange as well. And something that if you run one subject that's actually from a Masters of Public Administration in this program, you can see that there are great crossovers that would benefit everyone.
Have you read Peter Garrett's new book?
I haven't yet. I will.
Just published. The pre-publicity has him notoriously, everyone's zeroed in on one paragraph in an entire book, which is the way we work, of course, in the media. But in one paragraph, he apparently describes your former leader and Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, and parliamentary colleague as a complete megalomaniac.
And is there a question there? Because I suspect it's one I won't want to answer. You probably know, and some of your listeners would know, that I have been in the past quite public about my views of that time in government.
Well, you refused to serve his re-elevation to the Prime Ministership.
And I said at the time that I would explain that once publicly post my political life, which is now nearly 2 years ago, and have stuck to my vow that I won't do that again. The thing that I'm interested in with Peter's book, and it hasn't yet got any attention, is here's this amazing man who was a rock star, who ran the Conservation Foundation, who has all this other interesting life, and of course his perspective on politics. But actually, to be honest, the bit I'm most interested in reading is the bit pre-politics, because that's the bit I don't know. No, and the conservation movement, that's the part
the
I don't know as much about. And I think him being prepared to step from that life into politics was actually good for politics. Mm-hmm. I think he got a pretty rough run. Mm-hmm. But I hope that it would encourage people like Peter, with that history of activism and an amazing brain and passion, to go into politics, because for all the ups and downs, we need good people in politics and whatever side of politics, or else we're all worse off.
Do you miss it?
I don't, actually. It comes at a very high price, politics, and I think you can do it.
You mean a personal price?
Yeah, I just, you know, it's very intense. It has huge ups, but it has a lot of downs. And for me, 15 years was long enough, and I'm a bit of a believer that you should do things absolutely 200%. And when you feel like you're going to start resenting that, it's the time to go. Others, you know, can bat on for even longer. But I think it was an opportunity for a new, fresh Labor person to come into my seat. And Tim Watts has been doing a great job. So I think that's been proved right.
And there you were when the Tony Abbott postmortems were all being put on the television. There was that famous encounter between Tony Abbott and you when you were debating health policy and he had some rude words to say that he thought weren't being caught by the microphones but actually were.
Yes, well, a lesson to always know those microphones are there. No, but I have to say, it was almost like it really was a gift that kept giving. I mean, I was in opposition. I was not really a well-known spokesperson. Tony Abbott was a very well-known health minister.
In the
Howard government. And I think he underestimated the power of having done your preparation and didn't really respect that this was a big public debate.
Driving more towards the schadenfreude that you may have experienced over his toppling by Malcolm Turnbull.
I would not be human if I didn't admit to getting some enjoyment out of that. However, although Malcolm Turnbull is obviously from a different political persuasion to me, I'm actually hopeful that his prime ministership works, because the more effective he is, the more effective the opposition is, and it actually lifts the political debate into a space where we need it to be. We've had a pretty rough, you know, probably 7 or 8 years, and I'm hopeful that Tony Abbott leaving will rule a line under some of that in the interests of the country.
I've gone way over time. Nicola Roxon is now the chair of the Sir Zelman Cowan Courts and Tribunals Academy, to be launched by the Governor-General here in Melbourne. She's a former Federal Minister for Health and also a former Federal Attorney-General, which makes her eminently equipped for our next two guests. First up, Alan Goldberg, QC. A scholarship has just been created in his name at the University of Melbourne. Alan Goldberg, our first guest, and then Howard Nathan. Alan Goldberg's a retired federal court judge. Howard Nathan is a retired Supreme Court judge. What's it like being a judge and judging people for a living? That's the theme, a legal theme, on The Conversation Hour today.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Welcome, Alan Goldberg, AO, QC, retired federal court judge. He's on the board of the Tarrawarra Museum of Modern Art, the Australian Competition Tribunal former president, Council for Civil Liberties former president, former deputy chair of the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, but to most of Melbourne's legal community, he's just Goldie, Alan Goldberg. Good
Indeed.
Morning to you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here.
I was delighted to get a press release saying that there was a scholarship being created at the University of Melbourne Law School in your honour, Alan. How did it come about?
I'm not quite sure how it came about, John. I got a phone call one day from Mark Liebler's secretary saying, will you come up, and Mark wants to see you. I thought, that's unusual. Normally the bar rules are the solicitors come to see myself and other barristers. You know that form. Then I thought to myself, maybe he's going to offer me a partnership now I've retired.
he's the managing partner of Arnold Bloch, a big law firm.
Yes, but I rejected that opportunity many years earlier. So I went up and Mark said to me in very short terms, we've decided in conjunction with the university to create a permanent scholarship in your name. We started to work on it. We're progressing it. But we thought we'd better ask you for your consent. Do you agree? Now, that, as you well know, is capable of a yes or a no answer. But being a lawyer, I hesitated, thinking it through. It was a wonderful honour. I walked out, forgot to get my consent, and there was a luncheon 2 weeks ago where it was launched, where a substantial sum of money had already been donated, which meant that the scholarship was up and running.
It's not unheard of for people who have done well in life to want to create a monument to themselves very often, Alan, yes. But this is the reverse. This has been done by people who are grateful to you just to honour you without you making that contribution. It's kind of like it's a backwards endowment. Can I call it that?
Well, you can call it a backward endowment in a sense that I wasn't one of the persons who was promoting it. Was I the promotee or the promoter? I really don't know. All I know is that the scholarship was established in order to ensure that there were students who were very bright and who wanted to complete a legal education.
And who couldn't afford to.
And who couldn't afford it. And I thought that was a wonderful idea. I'd always wondered, John, how my name might be remembered in the law. You had the Dawson Inquiry, you had this inquiry, you had the media inquiry. What were you going to get from Goldberg? And I always wondered, and now the opportunity has been given, not for me to take, but for me to reflect upon and accept that it'll be in an educational concept. I'm not a concept, an educational context, which I've been interested in all my life.
And I think it's a great compliment, obviously, given the issues that you've championed, to have, I think the donors were clever. They knew you would never say no to something that's going to let someone that might otherwise not be able to have a law degree have that chance. And I think they seem to have picked a cause that they knew would strike a chord with you.
Well, they raised an enormous amount of money, basically, from four people initially. And had established it in a flash, as it were.
As a way of people saying, well, here's a remarkable man who otherwise, having made a contribution quietly, and it might amuse some who know you to think that you were making a contribution quietly because you're a very gregarious character, as is our next guest, Howard Nathan, retired judge. But you're not one of those who has gone around in the community seeking publicity that I'm aware of.
I don't think so. I didn't seek publicity because, well, for a number of reasons, but it always happened to be there, sometimes at the wrong time.
Because of the cases you were involved in?
Well, that's right. I got into trouble with animal lovers when a lady's guide dog collapsed in the witness box while I was cross-examining her, and the judge had to retire so we could revive the dog. That was one example.
You couldn't write that. You couldn't make up these stories, could you?
No,
the sorts of things you lived and saw in the courts are very varied, aren't they?
Yes, well, there are quite a lot of other stories that I won't bother you with now. I don't like telling what I call war stories, but there were many funny ones.
Well, and some, this is the sort of thing that happens when sometimes over a bottle of wine or two, lawyers sit down and tell war stories, breaching all the confidentiality, of course, that they've sworn to uphold for their clients.
John, if you've ever, as I'm sure you have, got in years ago into off Owen Dixon Chambers in a full lift and pressed the button and then listened, you heard an awful lot. The only reason that got finished was because one day a client came into the lift, pressed the button, didn't bother to look around him, and someone started to talk about what had just happened with this fellow in court.
Oh, dear.
So that wasn't regarded as very respectful
no,
and
to
it
the
wasn't.
Profession.
No, it wasn't. And sometimes people, you maintain a facade of discretion whilst in fact people can be notoriously gossipy and indiscreet behind the scenes.
But even not being gossipy, Alan, I think that a lot of listeners, if they've had exposure to the courts, it's often at a massively stressful or difficult time for them. So to hear from you and from our next guest some of the lighter moments is probably a bit of a revelation for people. Not the gossipy, difficult part, but the fainting guide dog is probably something people would never imagine. And you saw a lot of colourful cases in your time.
There was a time when I saved Snoopy. Children were coming home from kindergarten saying, Alan Goldberg saved Snoopy. All that happened was I took a trademark action on behalf of a client, went into the Supreme Court and got an injunction against someone breaching their trademark just before the Christmas holidays. Well, that was...
There's a dog theme here,
there
Alan.
There's a dog theme. And then when Bell Resources tried to take over BHP, my daughter took her school class to watch what was going on. They learned doing legal studies. And what was the headline in the Sun next day? The bell rings for toll. And who else? Katie's dad. And there was a story about her going to court
watch her dad
that day.
In the case. One of your more notorious court cases, though, was Dollar Sweets, where you were the QC taking on a case that shot Peter Costello to prominence. He was your junior, and it ended up in popular mythology. It was Peter Costello that ran the case as junior rather than Alan Goldberg, QC, as the leader.
Well, that was an incident that occurred where I was the senior counsel in Dollar Sweets. Peter Costello got apparently all the publicity. Everyone thought he'd been the person who'd run the case.
Did that irritate you?
It irritated me for 5 minutes, and I got angry for another reason. Peter Costello, or his solicitor, or the people involved who were using his activities, said that this was a unique application that has never been made before. So message one, who ran it? Message two, this was a novel principle. Wrong. The principle had been used in 1976 by, again, I was involved with a advertising agent who wouldn't unionise his shop. JGK Nominees Proprietary Limited.
JGK Nominees Proprietary Limited. Now, let me see.
Try. You've got
Jeffrey
10 seconds.
Jeffrey Gibb Kennett.
Correct. He was 28 at the time. The PKIU came to him and said, we want you to unionise your shop.
PKIU, Printed Kindred Industry Union? Yep.
Correct. He said, I support trade unionism. I support workers being together, but I do not require them to do so. And I'm not in favour of compulsorily getting people to come. So what happened in the composing room of the Herald and Weekly Times, his blocks, it was in the day of linotypes, he couldn't get his advertising copy printed. So we used the old cases round about the turn of the century that you will remember for your studies, I think Alan and Flood, Quinn and Leatham.
I don't remember much from my studies.
I'm just showing.
I was going to say, I really, really get, for any of your listeners who are worried that they don't, this is even for someone who's done a law degree and been the attorney, this is testing me.
Yes, well, the end result was that was wrong. I'd participated in that in 1976. And when Dollar Sweets came, I used that judgment. I think they called them in those days purple gutses. Remember the Roni Odmer sheets that come off for the unreported reporters that you flung out to the judge after you'd made your submissions?
Before photocopying was so readily available, yeah.
Oh, photocopying. Have you ever had to use a wet photocopier?
Oh, yes, I remember them, those blue machines and the smell. As soon as you talk about it, you remember it.
Well, every article, Clark, was exposed to that, as was I, for the enormous amount of... Well, I started on £7 a week.
£7?
Yeah.
Four.
After 2 weeks, I went and complained to my principal, would you believe? How stupid can you get? I said, I'm only getting £7 a week. My friend Ron Caston's getting 10, so is Jack Fagenbaum. I think I should get £10 a week.
You sound a bit like a unionist almost there, Alan.
Well, what happened was I was very nearly sacked. My principal told me to get out. Said if it hadn't have been for the dean advocating him taking me as an article clerk, I'd sack him on the spot, sack you on the spot. And I remained on £7 a week for the rest of the year.
And then you managed to move on from there.
Yes, I forget what happened when I was admitted. I think it went up to double figures. That's all I remember.
And I bet there was a lot of times in that boss's life that he regretted not having paid you properly as you went on and on to more prominence and power.
Yes, well, I did see him in different contexts later on. He was probably as surprised as I was where I was going.
Wonderful memories, and we could talk and Alan Goldberg could tell stories all through the morning, but Howard Nathan QC, retired Supreme Court judge, will join us in a moment. Alan Goldberg is a retired federal court judge, and the text messages are hitting the nail on the head. It's a recognition of a contribution that has been made quietly and with characteristic modesty behind the scenes on so many different fronts, for the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, Council for Civil Liberties, Tarawarra Museum of Modern Art, former president of the Australian Competition Tribunal, now retired federal court judge Alan Goldberg, AOQC, has had a scholarship created by grateful clients, former clients and others who recognise his contribution to the community. It's not something he's created for himself, no, it's the opposite. It's been created by others in recognition of his service. It's great to have you here. Congratulations,
Thank
Alan.
You.
And Howard Nathan QC, raconteur and also philanthropist, he's just donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to regional arts organisations. So he will join us as well with Nicola Roxon, former Attorney General and Health Minister, my co-host on The Conversation Hour today with a legal theme.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
And now Howard Nathan QC, retired Supreme Court judge, joins us because he has recently also engaged in extraordinary acts of generosity and philanthropy after a long and distinguished career as well. Hundreds of thousands of dollars donated to the Bendigo Art Gallery and also to Ullumbarra Theatre for repurposing an old jail. Howard Nathan, good morning to you.
Well, I didn't know you knew all that, and you shouldn't have known it either.
Why not?
Oh, I don't, you know. It's the best use of a judicial pension the state government could ever have imagined.
There's something, was it particularly because it's an old jail being turned into a gallery? Is there a little bit of...
Nicola, it's absolutely bonza, because I used to equip the jail with customers, and I was glad to go and have a look at this reconstruction and was able to brush out some of the graffiti relating to me, which was at least some sort of amelioration of the program.
Was there really any? Did it say anything particularly
yes,
juicy?
But it did indeed. It referred to physical features about which you need to know nothing.
Goodness.
Accurately or inaccurately?
Oh, I wish they were accurate, but I'm afraid they weren't.
I have a much nicer version of that. My husband used to say on election day, I always write something complimentary about you on the ballot paper when I vote for you just to give a smile to the scrutineers. And I said to him, what exactly do you mean? And I think some of them, not necessarily every woman would think we're complimentary. So we all have our crosses to bear.
I've got your application for the Sir Zelman Cowan Scholarship in hand, John.
Oh, excellent.
And Nicola and I are both promoting your application and signing it in your due form.
My application to do what?
To get the scholarship.
Oh, to...
Yeah, does the ABC know of your proposed transition?
Not only doesn't the ABC know, but I don't either, so you'll have to enlighten me.
Well, we thought that this scholarship, which is named in respect of Alan,
yes,
is for retraining and for students showing some promise. And since you've done the, primary degree, we thought we'd...
You did show promise then, John. I assume you still do.
Alan, I remember instructing you and Ray Finkelstein for 10 days in the federal court once with Woods Lloyd on the other side in a trial about Centrepoint Shopping Centre that was famous not just for the law that was established about trade practices and promises made to tenants to induce them to enter into leases in shopping centres, but it was famous for the banter.
Old Woodsy Lloyd was one of the wittiest persons at the bar. He would be gazing into space while someone was cross-examining, and all of a sudden he'd spring to his feet and he'd written some poem that somehow written into what was going on before the court. He was very clever.
So I'm dying to know then, given that both of you have this streak, unorthodox streak in you, whether you liked Rake, you know, the show that was, again, sort of the unorthodox barrister. Did it appeal to you
based
too?
Based on Charles Water Street in Sydney.
Yes, well, he was perhaps overdramatic. It's a matter of picking your time. My experience was that you could put humour into a case, but sometimes it rebounded upon you. Mm. I was in the High Court once, and the microphones there were very sensitive. And Justice Wilson said to me, "Mr. Goldberg, will you stop rustling your papers and turning them over? They're coming through the microphone and they sound like thunder." My dear idiot response was, "I'm sorry, Your Honour, I thought that was arguments approved from on high." Then I thought, well, I wish I hadn't said that.
But did you win?
No, I didn't.
Didn't
it's clearly the reason.
In fact, though, usually in Howard Nathan's court, the gags were coming from the bench rather than from the bar.
Never so.
Wait a minute. Guess Howard to tell you about the day. It was not very funny. I think that's a public story. It should be.
Oh, Ellen saved my life. Just in a passing reference, I had a customer who had been beaten up by her brother-in-law, and we sued and so on, and the disgruntled brother-in-law threatened to kill everybody, which he then went on to do, murdering three in the corridors of the Supreme Court and so on. And we'd come out after the case. My opponent had said, "Look, my customer's threatened to shoot you and shoot you all." It was junior to Ellen at this particular case somewhere else, so I rushed off.
Because Ellen had said, "Don't hang around. We're starting this case at 10:30.
Don't be late."
So yeah, sure. I rushed down the stairs and to get over to that court. And this particular fella did come out of the corridors of the court and topped three and wounded another two, with one bullet left in the gun for me.
And that led to a significant upgrade, and quite rightly too, of security in the courts, which is there to this day.
Yes.
If I hadn't have said to Howard, "Come to my court straight away, don't hang around with all the grateful things you always get," he would have walked off with the other people. And that fourth bullet.
Can I... Nicola was talking about Ellen being a shop steward and a union official and a sometime political activist. We had a marvellous case in which the concept of what was a group was involved. And you will remember the industrial groups, precursors of the DLP.
The groupers.
Yeah.
Bob Santamaria's.
I was on the Court of Appeal at the time, and the issue arose as to what was a group. One of the barristers said, if your honours would look at the Macquarie Dictionary for a definition, and the rather conservative judge on my right said, "Macquarie Dictionary? That's an Australian dictionary." And I said we'd look at it. So the Macquarie Dictionary came up about group, and my judge on the left said, "Group. I see it's got an entry. It's some sort of political animal. And what's this next entry? Group, grope, see, gang, bang."
Did every barrister look around who's going to say comment next? And oh, dear.
Oh, gosh. There's been such a huge and beneficial change to the benches since the advent of women and breaking down the misogynistic, male-dominated
I remember
barriers.
You saying, in fact, maybe on this program, upon your retirement when we got you in, Howard Nathan, you may remember you saying that it's so hierarchical. Judges are appointed in order of seniority. They come to the conference, the Judicial Weekly Conference, in order of seniority. They're asked to speak in order of seniority. And you said they'll even take a pee in order of seniority. Do you remember that?
I do.
Has it changed?
Very much so. I don't know that they've got as far as unisex toilets. I haven't had a personal examination, but the liberation that women have brought to the legal profession has been profound and deep, and I hope continues.
It's much more customer focused now. Now, you each also have another interesting overlap. You both flirted with politics at various stages in your career. Alan, you
mine
sought...
was more than a flirtation. I think he's talking about
Nicola.
The two of you, yes.
Now, Alan, you sought pre-selection for
Melbourne Ports
for the Liberal Party at one stage.
In 1969.
What led you to do so?
I joined the Liberal Party after I came back from studying in America. I wanted to get involved in politics. I'd been at Yale University. I'd gone through the burgeoning civil rights movement and wanted to get involved in politics. My friends laughed at me when I said I was going to get involved. I said to them, if you want to complain about the politicians, you've got to get involved. So you can't just sit by and whinge. So I joined the local Armidale branch, much to my wife's dismay. She had been a Labor voter all her life and continued for the next 25 years to be a Labor voter. I didn't get pre-selection. I think there were certain things against us. One was we used to go to meetings and the Conservative ladies would say, "What's it like to marry one, dear?" And she'd say, "I didn't marry in." That was the end of that. So I became secretary of John Gorton's electorate committee. Everyone was trying to stab him in the back, except when he turned 60 and I had to organise the 60th birthday party for him, everyone wanted to sit on the round table.
Yep.
And I fixed that up with all of those people.
You got to remind them of some of the things that had been said earlier on.
Oh, no, I was much more tactful than that. I said, "John and Bettina have got two sons, both of whom are bars at the bar." So I put their family at the round table. And as a matter of deference to protocol, Sir Magnus Cormack, because he was the senior Liberal person there. And that was an experience.
And the others all had to go and accept. And Howard Nathan, you flirted with politics, but on the other side, on the Labor side.
Oh, certainly. I had a degree of maturity to which Alan was aspiring at that time. And
he still maintains it, Your Honour, continue.
Yes, I did. I was fortunate. I had good positions in my political life without having to kiss a single baby. But can I ask, Nicola...
Well, make it clear. You were counsel assisting, I think was the formal title, to the then Attorney General John Kane, who was also Premier. So you effectively, because he was a bit busy being Premier, you effectively ran the entire hierarchy on his behalf.
Oh, no, I was very much John Kane's cipher, let me tell you. John... had his fingers on the pulse all the time. But I had a good time and it was good fun.
You were called the Attorney Colonel as opposed to the Attorney General.
Well, I had the funny experience when I was the Attorney General of going to the US and you meet with particularly all of their security agencies because of the partnerships that we have with them. But because they call all their lawyers attorneys, they call their Attorney General, General. So they would say, "Oh, General Roxon, come here." And it's quite disconcerting when you have no military background to suddenly be being called General and feeling like you should salute or something. So the Colonel is a new one that we can add to that list now.
But from the point of view, I mean, as Attorney General, you, of course, had to acquaint yourself with people of high office all around the country. It's always struck me, though, that Melbourne's legal profession, Melbourne's law community, has got some quite distinct characteristics to it. It's far more outward-looking than I've experienced anywhere else in Australia. Even for 4 years, I was the national reporter, law reporter for the ABC. Melbourne's legal community, completely different.
Well, I think Howard and Alan are perfect examples of people who, you know, were brilliant lawyers and brilliant judges, but always kept an interest in the broader community. And I think it's reflective of Melbourne's legal community. I think it would be fair to say the Melbourne legal Jewish community has always been very active, both in philanthropy and advocacy and civil rights. And interestingly, both of you from different sides of, you know, political background.
And also Aboriginal land rights. You mustn't forget the greatest contribution that Rottis Roncaston made.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's a refreshing...
All of that came out of the Melbourne Bar, all that work that Frank Vincent and John Coldrey did going up to Central and Northern Australia, all that stuff came out of Melbourne, all those test cases came out of Melbourne. That culture, the legal community culture, was much more outward-looking.
Yeah.
John, after I was involved in Dollar Sweets, the following year I appeared in the High Court for the BLF. Federal government been trying to close them down.
Was this still Norm Gallagher's time, or was he?
Yes, this was very much Norm Gallagher's time. And they had a process under the Act whereby you could deregister a union. And they'd been running that for about 2 years. They finally got sick of it, passed a statute that said a bill of attainder, the BLF is dead.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the High Court and said, that's unconstitutional. I prepared to take it on, because I was a member of the party, I wasn't. But I saw that as a civil rights issue. The trouble was, they were in bad odour by the community, not only the industrial community, but everyone else. The only person I remember who supported the BLF on that basis, I think it was Senator George Georges in Queensland. So I went to the High Court. I argued this was a bill of attainder. Historically, that wasn't allowed. I got a pleasant hearing. I didn't find the judges rude or aggressive because of my argument or because I was for the BLF. The end result was I made my argument. Gavin Griffith, the Solicitor General, put his argument very briefly, and the application failed. But that was an example of me acting for the Liberal Party on the one hand.
Dollar Sweets 1 year, BLF next year.
That's right. And I saw nothing unusual about that. But some people, I think at the Sydney Bar, they're more going to ask their own to get fear for them.
More tribal.
Look, there's an interesting addendum to that story, Ellen. When, as you say, I was appointed or became the attorney colonel, what was that called?
Attorney colonel.
Norm was had been slotted for his various contempts. And I got word from Pentridge that he was crook, sick, and the press announced that this was a political illness and so on. So I thought, my God, what happens if he dies in jail? Send out Collins Street, get every medical professional that you can. And sure enough, he was crook. And then he had the good sense to later die, which was fortunate for Victoria. And as I know that you can't defame the dead, even I can remember that, there will be no consequences following these remarks. Nicola, why did you become active in politics?
My family didn't have, I think I read Alan similarly, were not politically active, but they were very engaged in sort of social responsibility and social justice. And my father, in particular, when we were very young, was very keen, you know, if you can contribute or if you've got any particular talents, then you must. And that was, you know, I think really something from a young age. But my involvement ultimately was not from the family. I got involved in actually wages for women and the lack of equity. That led me to a bit of involvement with the union movement, which then led me to the Labor Party rather than any other way around. But I was late joining the Labor Party. I think I was 26 or something. I wasn't a young Labor person or involved when I was at university. And
I remember you, though, telling us you were inspired by your legendary aunt, the rock and roll historian Lillian.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a very strong thread of passionate women working in a bit untraditional areas. I think she was the first female Sydney Morning Herald journalist appointed at that time, worked under Darren Hinch in New York, and lots of interesting things. And women on the other side of our family who are the matriarchs and, in fact, involved in politics with the National Party. So there is that tradition of strong women, but there hadn't been a political tradition. I believe it is a fantastic way to contribute. You can contribute to public life in lots of ways, and I really hope that people are not scared off by some of the ugly side of it that you see, given how fulfilling, if you can achieve something, it really is.
Alan and Howard, I suspect that you could never have imagined back when you were on, Alan, you were telling us £7 a week as an article clerk in
1962.
You could never have imagined the world as, in fact, it's turned out now, let alone your own personal careers. So as you look back, and magnificent careers, all three of you, but as you look back, what lessons do you think we need to learn? What wisdom do you distill? Alan first.
The wisdom I distill is to be fully informed and to keep an open mind, make judgments on as full information as you can, but make judgments that you regard as being important to your way of life. That's what I've been saying to my five grandchildren.
Sort of be true to yourself in a way.
Well, it's being more true to yourself. It's more than being true to yourself. It's a process thing. Don't just take it for granted. You see a headline in the papers that says mosque dangerous, something like that. You've got to be very careful of labels today, John. And that's what I still into them. What I say to them is be careful of labels.
Okay. Howard Nathan?
Well, look, first of all, John, I think that society is improving. And I insist on a degree of optimism. Mostly, I think, because of the unchaining of the talents of all our population. Women's participation in every endeavour, which was unthinkable when I was a young colt around the law courts. I think that there is a greater concern for the general community. We do look outwards. We are in favour of Australian aid here and Australian aid there everywhere. And in other places. We're more culturally diverse.
Inclusive.
We're more intellectually diverse. Australian development is really a paradigm for the rest of the world. We've done very, very well when you look at the very broad picture over time.
With one qualification, our refugee policy.
Well, at the moment, yes, indeed. It's very I'm not suggesting that it hasn't got ugly features. There's plenty of ugly features on the Australian escutcheon. But on the whole, it's pretty good. Where would we go from here? I think on the same path, insisting upon openness and diversity and tolerance. Our history is pretty good. Our future is even better.
Much of which is often lost sight of, Nicola.
Yeah, I think the strongest message from my perspective is work hard at what you're doing, but keep your eye kind of above the horizon as well. You know, understanding what else is happening in the world makes you a better person at whatever you're doing. You can get too narrow, and I think actually at the next generation are very good at those connections, and we need to keep growing it, because you're right, the world is opening, and that's a positive if we keep being protective and respectful of each other.
Lots of fan mail coming in from people saying how they've enjoyed receiving the combined wisdom of our three guests today. My co-host Nicola Roxon, Alan Goldberg QC, retired Federal Court Judge, and Howard Nathan QC, retired Supreme Court Judge. Howard Nathan has bestowed huge philanthropic gifts on regional arts facilities in the last few years, and Alan Goldberg has had a scholarship named and created in his honour by a grateful community and former clients and people who have had the benefit over the years of his guidance and wisdom. It's been great to have you both here, and thank you. Howard Nathan, Alan Goldberg, Nicola Roxon, it's been good fun today, and thank you ever so much for coming in, and all the best to all of you on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.